Now stay tuned for To Your Health, where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating over 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. And by Rebecca's Natural Foods in the Barracks Road Shopping Center. Now here is your host, MC Blair.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, everybody. This is MC Blair right here at WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. To Your Health, welcome, welcome. We are talking today with Alexander Olison of Babylon Gardens. Actually, that's the Babylon. What is it?
Babylon Micro Farms.
Micro Farms. Hey, Alexander, how are you doing?
Very good, thanks, Mike. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. Can you hear yourself?
I can. Is this just testing?
Oh, wait a minute. Try that.
Hello. Yeah.
Much better, huh? All right. A little technical stuff here. And so Babylon Micro Farms. That's excellent. And I had Alexander here, oh my goodness, right? First or second show. And he had a prototype. And if you can imagine, it was, you know, it was 2x4s and kind of slammed together. But I got the idea. And then he was very, very excited about what he was going to be doing. And fast forward to today, he's over there at one of the labs at UVA. I visited you over there. And when I did, I saw this incredible progress has been made. And you have some of your micro farms in a restaurant or two. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it's come a long way over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. We're now installed at the Boar's Head Resort. We're in the UVA dining halls. And we have a number of projects range anywhere from Lexington to Richmond. And we'll be continuing to expand our footprint across Virginia this year, which is really exciting.
Yes, it is.
And we're finally coming out of R&D mode, which is always exciting.
R&D, you can get stuck there for a while, right? It's like the wheel of death on a Mac. Just tell us a little bit, you know, about what it is. What is Babylon Micro Farms?
Sure. So as in the initial concept started at a lab in UVA, where we were exploring low-cost sustainable food systems, I'm sure this segment speaks about a lot, is the issues we face with our food system and the lack of sustainability and transparency within it. And we were looking into ways that we could use hydroponics to grow crops sustainably. So hydroponics, you dissolve the nutrients in water.
Right.
And it's a much more sustainable way of growing. So the plants, it's like an IV drip to them. They get exactly what they need at any one time. So it's much higher nutritional content. Crops can be grown year round under control conditions. It uses 90 to 95% less water than growing outdoors. Plants grow twice as quickly, no pesticides or chemicals. So way back then, I was like, okay, I'm sold on this. If that's true, it solves a lot of the fundamental issues that we see with our sort of industrial food system. And that sort of stayed core to what we are doing now, is building technology to accelerate the transition towards sustainable indoor agriculture. And while it's not the solution, it's just part of the solution, but it can allow for a lot of the highly perishable crops, leafy greens, ending up to sort of fruits and veg and other sort of larger, more calorific crops to be grown indoors sustainably. And so you're seeing it now that the industry is really emerging, and a lot of countries, developing countries, are investing heavily in it as a way of, almost for national security reasons. So we have seen this space sort of grow. And I think since you first visited, we've also changed our kind of, while the mission remains the same, the products we're producing are very different, and we're now much more focused on large-scale commercial installations. But when I say large-scale, you know, we are still micro-farming, so these are a lot smaller than your conventional agricultures, conventional greenhouses. So, and what we found is the technology we've developed simplifies the process so much that we can build farms at a much smaller scale, and they're still economically viable. And that means we can actually build farms at the point of consumption, which is a really new concept actually in the space, and it's something that we are really leading the charge in, our ability to build farms at the point of consumption. And that what that means is that places like the Boar's Head Resort can become self-sufficient in a lot of their key ingredients. So like I'm sure many of the listeners have heard of farm to table. This is taking it one step further.
Right. This is the farm next to your table. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's one of the things I've noticed that I found quite interesting is that you've got your box with everything, the medium and all your nutrients are going through, and constantly moving and hydroponically, but then you can stack other boxes on top, so you can basically get a large area vertically and not take up much space in wherever it is, the restaurant mm-hmm. or the dining hall. Or
yeah, well, it's one of the things that makes controlled environment agriculture so attainable for a lot of places, is that you can stack these layers on top of each mm-hmm. other. The one in the Porseco is up 10 feet high, and they can pack in a lot of produce into a very small area.
Sure. And it's neat, I guess, that the server or hostess or whoever greets you, and they can point it out. And I like what you did with the different colored lights, which just makes it look really cool.
I don't want to take responsibility for the lights. The lights are a necessary piece of the controlled environment act. So you basically recreate sunlight, and they are specialized grow lights, which have a nice color to them.
I thought that was actually decoration, that you still had your grow lights, but then you had your different colored lights to where it made it look cool. The one was, I believe, kind of like an iridescent purple or something.
We've actually moved a little bit away from the bubble ones, but they have for certain crops, they're great. But no, it's certainly a visually appealing, it's all visually appealing. So
it really is.
It's nice to go into the office and have a farm.
Well, I know. It's like, what do you want for your salad? Oh, well, how about some micro broccoli or something, for nutrition? Cause I know those, mm-hmm. the broccoli sprouts are probably mm-hmm. 4 to 5 times more nutritious than the broccoli itself. It's interesting.
Yeah, like a lot of microgreens, it's a very popular crop to grow mm-hmm. indoors because, it's a lot of nutrition. It's got fresh out of the seed.
Yeah. You're listening to Your Health on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, the voice of resistance right here in Charlottesville, Virginia. And I'm talking with Alexander Olson of Babylon Micro Farms. Alex, tell me about what we were talking earlier, and you were saying that it could be made industrial size to where you could feed a certain percentage of, say, Charlottesville in the wintertime, possibly even to people with lower means, as a an urban reach out or something like that. Do you have any sort of plans like that, or have you thought about it?
Yeah. So it's actually a very big part of our plans is, as I mentioned earlier, we've increased the size of our units. So we've mm-hmm. moved away from sort of individual home use. While that might come back into the picture later, we found that actually even at a significantly larger than home use, but still relatively small compared to the industry, you can grow a significant amount of food. And part of our plans there is to really sell directly to the places that is either consuming mm-hmm. or selling it. So we have some exciting pilots here in Charlottesville with Rebecca's Natural Foods.
Oh, good.
Other places where we can actually bring the produce right there and sell it on. Mm-hmm. And the key thing that we've realized is through the technology we've developed and the cost savings we've created, we can actually make cost-effective farms that are indoor. So that means that you're going to see a lot more of this, as it is really a sensible economic
so decision. Good. Rebecca's, of course, is one of our sponsors, so I'm glad you have a deal going with them.
I thought I'd drop it in.
Yeah. Good. Very good. That's excellent. Yeah. You should be in radio. No. So, tell us a little bit more about, the future, because I know you're very excited about your future.
You have to be, I think, to keep going. We have a lot of exciting projects. Like the pipeline of things in Virginia we're building is really exciting, and we're mm-hmm. going to see a lot more of this indoor farming. Geographically, we're in an area that needs it. There are huge seasonal fluctuations. We have a lot of the perishable produce imported from across the country, and we obviously have a thriving food scene that wants this sort of more out of season and rare variety. So I think there's the demand and the sort of conditions are right. Our technology is there. We're now deploying it, which is really exciting. But we also have a lot of other really sort of pioneering projects with UVA. So we work closely with the Sustainable Enterprise Lab mm-hmm. there, and we're deploying a farm out in Dominica. So as you mentioned earlier, sort of our to help people grow food. I think that is key to what we're doing. And, you know, it's kind of a chicken egg thing where we have to develop the technology. We have to sell to the nice, you know, high-end hotels and places to test it out.
Right.
But over time, there is so much potential for this in developing countries, in food deserts, to kind of bring farming back into urban areas.
That's right. When you were first here, you were talking about that and how once you get the technology and you know, fully funded and all the stuff you have to do, that can be a wonderful outreach worldwide to developing countries.
I think that's definitely part of the plan. And the sort of the brains of what we do is this networking farm. So what that means is we are able to remotely monitor and control all the farms within our network.
Mm-hmm.
So every farm we build is essentially just expanding that. And as a result, it really could be a global thing. You know, we're not tied. We don't actually own or operate any of these farms, but we help anyone who does own a farm run it and ensure they get the highest quality results, best flavors, highest yields. And so it is a very sort of, it has the potential to scale exponentially.
That's outstanding. You had mentioned when, you know, 3 years ago about home use.
Yeah. So I still believe it's a huge opportunity. The challenges of launching a consumer product are significantly greater than launching a business product. So what we're doing is building out this network of productive farmers that really focus on the economics behind growing. Like, can we grow produce mm-hmm. indoor in urban areas at a competitive or cheaper than what it costs to import it? And the answer is yes to that. And so we're going to prove that out. And I think the home use, it is kind of the natural progression of this. It's where... But you need to kind of build the trend, build momentum before you can go into that market.
So what else? I know you've got lots of information. Oh, you have some press.
Oh yeah. So this week actually we were featured on the front cover of Maximum Yield, which may not be everyone's regular magazine, but it is the industry, one of the industry's leading publications. For
Trade Paper. That's excellent. Yeah. I was looking at some of the pictures in there. It was pretty neat.
Yeah, and so one of the things we're doing, which is sort of not related to the press, but it's a really exciting partnership with the Jefferson Center for Historic Plants at Monticello. And what we're trying to do is generate growth recipes for mm-hmm. crop varieties that aren't currently grown for food in the sort of conventional food system. So something I hope a lot of your listeners are probably very aware of, given it's a whole show, is that a lot of the food you buy in the supermarket has been bred or selected for durability, shelf life, not flavor, not mm-hmm. nutrition, not mm-hmm. a lot of the things that actually matter to you as a consumer. And so really there's a lack of biodiversity within the food system. But you know,
that's very true.
And what we're trying to do is celebrate that and figure out, you know, that even lettuces, there are hundreds of varieties of lettuce, but you can only buy four or five of them in the supermarket. Mm-hmm. So we're actually going through finding new varieties of seeds that haven't been grown hydroponically before, growing them, testing them, learning how to grow certain new crop varieties. And that means that any of these farms within our network will have access to those. So we're actually trying to reintroduce new crop varieties into the food system. Which I think is pretty exciting.
It's very exciting. And of course, the first thing, having come from a restaurant background and catering background, I'm thinking there's almost no waste.
That is actually, we don't play up to that enough, because like the challenge with that is it's ultimately up to the owner of the farm. Like, they could still be wasteful. But generally speaking, yeah. That's one of the... that's potentially one of the bigger benefits, especially in sort of grocery store segments, places like that, where you can grow this stuff on site and you harvest it as and when you need it. And given that we specialize in largely very perishable crops,
right.
It's needed. Yeah, it's kind of the only way to do it.
Well, it is. And then the other thing is, you know, I'll buy, we'll say I love broccoli. I buy a lot of broccoli. And I'll get it from, you know, say Rebecca's and during the wintertime. Now, we know it didn't come locally. Sometimes it is. I think there's a few greenhouses that do it. But if it's not that, then I put it in my crisper, and 3 days, 4 days later, it's starting to deteriorate, which tells me that was probably harvested 3 weeks ago or a month ago, you know, as opposed to this. And when I buy something fresh from City Market, you know, 10 days later, it's still good.
Yeah, and you can really tell the flavor. Like, as I was saying, we're really on the perishable side where it's so noticeable. Even a day after harvest, it is a different plant to what it was.
Oh, nutritionally, lettuces lose so fast.
Even like, you know, you look at apples, the average time an apple takes to get to the US is 11 months.
No.
Yeah. So there are, you know, there are a lot of it, but they're an example where they're cold stored in a sort of oxygen free environment,
right,
coated in wax, and most people eat them without even washing them. But,
but
I'm saying that kind of trend is all around the food system, and broccoli and other places probably flown in from South America, and it doesn't make sense. And actually, if you're trying to create sort of positive change and build a more sustainable future, it's important that the supply chain is more widely known about and the issues with it.
And closer to home. Mm-hmm. And then when that happens, of course, if people start eating, they become educated, like in city schoolyard gardens. Mm-hmm. We've had them on here before a couple of times. And when you educate the children, you get a more educated adult down the road.
Yeah, and it's also, you see the sort of farm-to-table movement, things like that. It is all kind of part of the same conversation, but it's all often broken up into different pieces where the inequality and disenfranchisement of sort of small communities in the U.S. relates closely to this kind of industrial food system where you're able to sort of corporatize and pull profit away from the small local farmers. So helping them is obviously one side of this, and that's great, and actually helps everyone in the process.
Well, absolutely. We mentioned earlier, possibly helping some of the disenfranchised people locally during the wintertime when the local farms aren't producing produce. And then in the summer, you know, you could have maybe students come in, have a camp, that type of thing. There's people that I'm sure you're quite aware of who you can partner with to get that get the people educated. We are going to take a slight break here, but we will be back with Alexander Oleson and Babylon Microfarms. And we are back right here to your health. This is MC Blair. We are broadcasting from 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and we're speaking with Alexander Oleson of Babylon Micro Farms. You were just getting ready to get into, I believe it was education, and we were talking about the...
Yeah, yep. So we have a sort of growing partnership with UVA, which is really exciting. We have, you know, anything from capstone engineering students to kind of sustainability and environmental science majors involved, which is really rewarding, actually. And you see that certainly, I think, the real-life applications of all this make for a pretty interesting academic research. And then on the other side, we're definitely talking with the Charlottesville City Schoolyard Garden. They, as an organization, we actually donated some of our original prototypes to them. So I think they still have them at Charlottesville High. We'd love to get them some of our newer systems. I think they're probably a little easier to use.
Well, they're good folks over there. Did you deal with Richard Morris or... You don't remember who it was?
Exactly. Of course,
Jeanette Ivy-Nader is the head of that, and we had, I believe, who we have, Eileen Carey on from over there as well. There's a great organization. I really like what they're doing. So hopefully they'll be able to teach the kids about the hydroponics as well from that and get people interested in doing it themselves.
Well, that's a big part of it. You know, we've certainly considered, like, how do we get more people involved? Because there is a certain sort of educational component to it, because the benefits are pretty clear, but the process of sort of what it takes to get involved, while it is very simple, most people just don't know about it. And for a lot of people, I think these things are quite intimidating until they sort of really break it down and you realize, oh, that's actually very easy. And then with all of the technology and support we provide, it's actually incredibly easy.
So you're getting good feedback then from the students and also the teachers, is that?
Yeah, it's different. So the benefits of working with UVA is they largely kind of drive their own, you know, they've got their own agenda, they have their own classes, so we're not teaching per se, but we're providing them a platform from which they can do their own research. Which is great, as in we're not really in the game of teaching per se, but I think it's something we're open to, and we think it's really good to get involved for that kind of thing.
Oh, okay, right. So then by partnering with these groups that do teach, then you can still achieve the same goal without you being directly involved.
Exactly. And yeah, they're building a farm. We're helping them build a farm at Morven Kitchen Garden, which is
up good.
The Morven Estate just up in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And that's a prelude to this one in, or precursor to the one in Dominica, which is really that. So they have a class that goes out there every summer. So it's sort of working reciprocally with them.
Oh, my goodness. No, that is great. So what else? You've got, I know you've got lots of things to tell our folks and, you know, maybe put a shameless plug in there for somebody, you know, mention some of your, you know, partners.
Yeah. So the Boar's Head Resort, if you haven't been there, actually, I don't know if they're open. I think they must be opening pretty soon.
Yeah.
They have undergone this incredible renovation, and our farm is just a small part of it, but it is, in this old historic building, which used to be for catching your own fish as this sort of trout house. And we've built the farm in there, so it's sort of reinvigorating that kind of culinary innovation. And this is, you can get a tour of that, and the chef loves to do that. So.
Oh, my goodness. Do they still have the fish?
No.
They don't have the fish anymore.
We actually looked in. So aquaponics is, essentially using fish waste to feed plants.
Right.
We looked into that fish smell, and it's
it's pretty nasty smell.
Yeah.
There's a chef. I won't mention who it is, but he's in England, and he has
aquaponics,
right? Aquaponics, and it's terraced, so he starts up high, and there's like fish there, and then the water comes down, and it starts feeding, you know, the produce and whatnot, and then there's like another pond with, you know, frogs and lizards and stuff like that, and it keeps going. And his whole property is done that way. And so he's getting, you know, fresh produce.
It's interesting. There are a lot of like very elaborate and complex kind of closed loop, sustainable agriculture systems, all of which are like amazing. And you know, we're pretty supportive of it. But a lot of what we've tried to do is how do we really simplify it and actually kind of demystify a lot of the hydroponic part of it. So we've managed to automate a lot of that where, it's interesting because we see some really elaborate case studies that are out there. We're like, wow, that's just so it's incredible and very sustainable, but it is also out of reach of most people.
Yeah.
Whereas we're really trying to use technology to make it as simple and as
possible. I was down at Epcot Center and they had the hydroponics down there, and totally different than what you're doing. You know, their medium was dripping down the roots, you know, and then would go and then be recycled and re-nourished and then come back again. So, but the roots were all, they had the roots hanging down. It was totally different than what you do.
It's a lot of like, as I said, the industry as a whole, like sort of hydroponics, and that there are so many shades of it, but the industry is growing a lot, which is exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing, you know, here you can do it indoor, you can do it outdoor, you can have greenhouses, you can have vertical farms like ours. So it's a very exciting place to be.
Well, I like what you're doing. I really do. And I think it could be something that could be, say, put on rooftops on these, you know, these, Friendship Court is going to be, they're going to raise a lot of those homes down there to put up high rise still for, you know, for the affordable housing, but a high rise format instead of what they have now.
I'm not aware of the property development, but I know they've got a sort of an urban farm sort of project going on there, which we're pretty keen to get involved with.
Oh, they do. I went around there with Todd Niemeyer when he was had Urban Agricultural Collective of Charlottesville, UACC, and now someone else has taken that over. He's, of course, somewhat involved, you know, like on the board or something like that. But then that's when he mentioned that, you know, we went to that garden specifically, and then he mentioned they were going to be doing that, and he was talking about rooftop gardens, and I thought that your, you know, Babylon Microfarms could be involved in that as well.
It's interesting, what we're doing, I think, might be a little out of reach for now, but it's sort of where we're going. It's all part of the same conversation. You're seeing it around the U.S. and really around the world, that not only do people want this, you know, the demand is there, but it's also pretty clear the benefits of it. And you see in New York, they just passed a bill that requires new builds to, like, look into green roofs and sort of rooftop farming. The farm bill that was just passed recently is setting up an office for urban agriculture and indoor agriculture. They're doing a census of all urban farming. And I think when that comes out in about 12 months, you'll see that this is a a very pretty macro trend that everyone everywhere is doing it in very small incremental ways, but the big picture means that this is something that people are embracing, and it's sort of a movement, really, because it actually helps, you know, helps everyone. It helps the environment in the urban areas. It helps the people who are getting better food. Gives people something to do. It's all a lot of positives to it.
No, I think of a rooftop garden, and you know, the people talking, well, we'll just bring up a lot of soil, and we'll have, and then we'll plant our crops, and you know, it'll be on the top there, and the, you know, the neighbors can help, and all that. But that soil weighs, you know, when you talk about a rooftop, you have to start talking about weight. And I believe your method is, I would think it would be less weight.
I don't know. I don't have numbers to support that. I think overall it is, but we actually did look into one rooftop in Richmond, and weight was actually still an issue.
Oh, really?
Because we do still use water, which is very heavy.
True, without the soil, because the soil is pretty heavy too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and it's only at certain times, and the weight's fairly concentrated in the reservoirs. But I think most roofs, unless they were built with kind of a purpose in mind to like have people up there or other things, they're normally not strong enough to suddenly take like a ton of weight. You know.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about the ongoing controversy, hydroponic soil.
I think there shouldn't be any controversy, but there always is. But it there was a legal dispute between organic foods and hydroponics calling themselves organic. So on a sort of scientific level, hydroponics is, for all intents and purposes, organic. It is, you know, no pesticides, no chemicals, no harmful chemicals, and no. I think the dispute is really around the bacteria in the soil. To which I kind of stay impartial. Like, I know our systems. I eat all of the food from our systems. I think it's fantastic. It tastes great. It's very pure. However, there is obviously this kind of hydroponics has the potential to really disrupt the organic foods because it's so much more productive, tastes so much better. You have so much more control. So, you know, to that end, I can see why the organic foods people are trying to kind of discourage it and create a disclaimer around it. But you know, it's really worked in the favor, like the recent E. coli scare. The hydroponically grown lettuce was, after that, labeled as separately so it could continue to be sold because it's free from any contamination. And I think we're going to see more of that because I think, you know, there's a sort of bigger conversation here around corporate America and stopping the interest, like a positive social change happening if it hurts their bottom line. Of which I'd say the organic food lobby falls into, and hydroponics actually has great promise to bring healthier, more nutritious food to people around the country.
Yeah, I know. I know that if the farm is managed properly, that food is, you know, fully healthy. And you know, I did take a tour at Polyface in the valley, and they were in the middle of I guess at the time this was like 02, and they were still in the middle of about a 25-year drought, and the farms on both sides were brown and hardtack, and his fields were all mushy and big, tall green grass, and that's because the animals go around and get fresh pasture and all that, and it's properly maintained. It's drought proof because it wicks, you know, the water. But that takes years and years to get to that point.
So the amazing stuff they've done at Polyphase is a great example. As in, it's funny, Joel Salatin is actually someone who's a big advocate against hydroponics.
Oh.
But, you know, I think it's important. Biodiversity is important, as you were saying, the natural environments which are capable of kind of supporting themselves and healing. And that all comes from biodiversity and having kind of a... having that around, and you can train the land to have that, and it's something they've done incredibly. You know, Polyphase Farms, I think, is a global case study of what to do. But yeah, it takes years, and I don't think they are mutually exclusive. I think that should happen in all farms, and I think hydroponics should happen in cities. And I think
I think it can work together.
And you know, it's something we found actually one of the pushbacks we have, and I think we spoke about it just before the show, is like, what do you do in the summer when all the farmers are harvesting? We have to find, you know, that's part of the benefits of micro farming is we are not moving into Charlottesville saying we're the guys who grow lettuce and like kind of, we want to own that supply. And, you know, we work in harmony, allowing restaurants and institutions to take control of the more perishable produce. They can grow lettuce in the winter when they can't buy it in Charlottesville. They could grow herbs and flowers in the summer when the farmer's growing lettuce. You know, we the benefits of micro farming is it's a very flexible system that can work symbiotically with the existing.
No, I agree. I think it can, and I mean it just it takes a you know a community's effort to do exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's things that you can share with farmers they can learn. You can learn from that. I mean, it just, you know, as you say, it's a symbiotic relationship between folks because you're not there saying, I'm going to crush the farmer, you know, and I'm going to put them all out of business. and I know you're not that person. That's for sure.
Yeah. We're actively trying to work with existing farmers. And even the micro farming is actually an opportunity for farmers, anyone, you know, anyone who's listening who is an organic farmer or non-organic farmer for that matter, you know, a small micro farm could take up a couple hundred square feet, and it's a way to extend your growing season in the winter. You can use it for plant propagation in the summer. Like, there are a lot of benefits to these, and they're kind of a non-invasive way to enhance your existing operation, whether that's outdoor, organic, whatever it might be. These are a really turnkey solution that helps people grow more for a longer period of time.
And affordable.
Yeah, and that's a very key point. Like, the modularity of our system and the technology we've developed is orders of magnitude cheaper than what's currently out there, more complete. So we bring a lot of very advanced technology into a very simple and intuitive app that runs the whole thing. And the individual modules themselves are very, very cheap relative to what's out
there. And if somebody were to, say, purchase this for their home, they would get the nutrients, the medium from you, is that how that works?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, we provide like a full sort of on-demand farming service. So the technology allows us to remotely manage the farm. So while we don't, the users own their farm, we are actually helping them and ensuring that they get the best quality results, the highest yields, the best quality flavors. And part of that process is sending them all of the seeds and nutrients they need. Of course, they can grow their own seeds if they want to, but we have that option, which enables them to kind of really streamline the operation. Like, the Boar's Head's here, an example, you know, their chef and culinary team, they want high quality food, they want best flavors, but they don't want to be sitting around like seeding and, you know, messing around with learning how to do it. So they get all the benefits without any of the stress.
So you actually service that?
We remotely manage it and we provide
the service. Oh, remotely?
But they will
harvest through the app?
Yeah. Well, so through sensors, and then they all they have is a very simple app that kind of just tells them what to do and guides them through the growing process.
So when they need new seeds and all that sort of thing, you guys,
we just deliver it to them.
You just deliver it, and it's ready to go.
Yeah.
Oh, so it's not actually putting the seeds in. In other words, you have a, what is it? This is like a little module or?
And they come pre-seeded. What we've done is try to address a lot of the most time-consuming or laborious parts of having an indoor farm. So, for instance, spending 10, 20 minutes seeding up little growth plugs that support the plant, that's something that we don't think farmers should have to do. And actually, if we do it all in bulk, it actually can save them a lot of time, and it's fairly simple for us.
So then it's like a little plug.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, so the plug, like grass sometimes will come in plugs, like Zoysia grass or something. And so
the growth mediums we use, as in there are various different types. We try and use the most sustainable ones. Mm-hmm. But, for instance, the rock wall is a heated mineral wall. It has no chemical properties, but it's great because it supports the plant. And then we're able to add in all the nutrients and stuff that it needs to grow.
My goodness. That's a great service to provide. They don't have to do that. So, and you're in the Boar's Head. You're working with Rebecca's, so they're selling some of your products. Is that?
Listen, they will actually have a farm in the store very soon.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah,
I love the people over there. That's really nice. That's awesome. So what else is going on with Babylon Micro Farms?
Well, we have a couple of different things that are going on. So we primarily, we're working with more and more restaurants, sort of clubs, resort, that kind of thing. But we're also doing a sort of a model farmer program where aspiring urban farmers or indoor agriculture sort of enthusiasts can actually look into getting one of our farming modules at a fraction of the conventional cost in order to give us feedback. So we have a lady in Lexington that we're installing with. She is actually going to be selling the produce. She's been doing it as a hobby, but she wants to upgrade her production. And so we're really keen to support that and get her feedback, because that's where... I think we mentioned that we're not doing the residential stuff at the moment, but we do see this as an opportunity for homeowners down the line. And so to really be able to get that feedback. So if there's anyone listening who who wants to become a sort of model farmer, please, you know, reach out to us on our website, BabylonMicrophones.com. And we, we'd love to get more of these farms into the hands of individuals so they can grow their own food to consume or to sell, and really just see how that process works.
And again, the website, BabylonMicrophones.com.
That's correct.
Yeah, and just reach out and you know, express your interest in becoming a model farmer.
Exactly. Yep.
That's awesome, man. We're going to take another little break, but we will be back shortly. Hey, welcome back. This is MC Blair. I'm talking with Alexander Olson of Babylon Micro Farms. However, right now, I want to play a little interview I had with Amy Leeser. She's a nurse practitioner, and we were talking about food as medicine. So, and this is MC Blair. I'm sitting here with lovely Amy Leeser. She's our guest today. She's a nurse practitioner with UVA System. Hi, Amy.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yeah, Hippocrates that said, "Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food."
There it is.
So a great quote that I love. Yeah.
That is a great quote. That was Hippocrates, right?
Yes.
And now doctors take a Hippocratic oath, right? From Hippocrates. So why have they added that one? And that says do no harm, right?
I think they need to put
that in there, you know, and make that at the forefront, because I think that would, I know that that would change a lot of people's thinking. They would turn more towards diet. There would be more emphasis on nutrition in the training. We would have a healthier country, less sickness and lower doctor bills, lower copays, insurance rates would drop.
Have an epidemic of chronic diseases that are related to diet and lifestyle, and so I think looking to that as a solution makes sense.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting to look at the history of food, and so for centuries we relied on food as a source of energy and health and connection. But then over the last 50 to 60 years, there were some changes in the food supply, and like we talked about, how we use food has contributed to some extent to this growing epidemic of chronic disease. So processed foods alter the food supply and interfere with the best use of those food nutrients. So, for example, hydrogenated oils, adding sugars, and then like these toxic agricultural chemicals we talked about, they do make the shelf life longer, and they make things prettier, and they appeal to our sweet tooth. But, you know, as a steady diet, they can lead us towards disease. So just recognizing this historical food, that food represented a connection within the community and families and friends, and this loss of connection has also decreased preparation of food from scratch and then increased our intake of processed food. So we're not making food together as much as we did decades ago. So these schoolyard programs are really encouraging not only the local organic food agriculture, but also bringing back this sense of connection and learning through food. So some interesting statistics. So school, last I looked, maybe 20 to 25% of time at school is spent in the schoolyard, hopefully more. But fifth grade students that participated in schoolyard gardening activities scored higher in science achievement tests. They also showed significant increase in self-understanding, the ability to work in groups. Also, these multicultural gardening programs for recent immigrants helped them share their cultural heritages, feel a sense of belonging, and then also 100% of schools using environmental-based learning had students with improved behavior. Not only attitudes, but also test scores.
Oh, man.
So 77% of schools with environmental-based curriculums had improved standardized test scores.
So learning through agriculture.
Yeah. And then 73% had improved grade point averages. So, and across the board, so improved science, geography, social studies, math, English. So really a wide range of increase in not only achievement in school, but also self-understanding and ability to relate to one another. So that connection through food and bringing that back through the schoolyard garden is really amazing.
Yeah.
There was a study in Michigan State University. They looked at obesity and schoolyard gardening, and they showed that when they had healthy snacks based on the schoolyard gardening practices, the overall daily consumption of fruit increased by 26% and vegetables increased by 14%. And really, the kids just began to choose healthier options because of the education. They understood.
Well, they obviously were feeling better and feeling more communal with even people from, like you said, different cultures. And so that just makes them better citizens and oh, my goodness, you know. And then, of course, I'm sure that they'll hear, you know how your kids learn from you. I mean, that's just how it is, you know.
Yes.
And we learn from our parents and our kids will learn from us. And you'll see kids out there today say, you know, exhibiting these hateful things that you'll see in politics, which we're not going to get into, but they learn that from their parents. So now if the kids are learning these things at school and working with people from the other cultures, then my goodness, maybe they'll teach the parents. You know what I mean? You know, say, hey, that's not the way it is. You know, I'm with so-and-so and this, you know, these kids, you know what I mean? They're, you know, can't we just get along kind of thing? So it's just, that's why the education, you know, that's why educating the students of the present to change the adults of the future is obviously the way to go, and why these schoolyard programs are so important.
Yeah.
I call it sustainable schools, right? Amy, tell us a little bit about yourself, why you went to nurse practice. You were a nurse first, and then you went into the MP field, right?
Yeah, I started my career at Duke, and then I went to the University of Washington in Seattle, and then the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And so after working at several academic centers and getting some good experience and I did some intensive care, I found my home and family practice. And I just really love walking with the patient throughout different phases of life and creating that relationship. So right now, I'm at Forest Lakes Health Center, which is a University of Physicians group, part of the University of Virginia. And I am just really passionate about getting down to the root of people's health concerns and trying to restore health in the body. So I'm very fortunate that UVA has supported my continuing education. And most recently, I've completed some coursework with the Institute of Functional Medicine. And so I would encourage listeners to go to the Institute of Functional Medicine and look into that approach. And they're doing some great research in the Cleveland Clinic about health outcomes and cost reduction. So if you want to try that approach, you can certainly schedule with me, and it's a unique lens to look at healthcare. And so really, I like to look at the body kind of like this ecosystem of interconnected network of systems.
Yeah.
So like for an ecologist who would successfully restore a disease ecosystem, they have to look at the interdependence between the fish and the insects and the water. And so just like an ecologist restores health in that way, I also try to look at all the different systems of the body. And I find that kind of restoring that balance of health throughout different systems not only helps to prove disease, but also people find a higher level of energy and vitality. So it's a neat approach that I find patients are really resonating with. So.
Wow, that's really neat. So functional medicine, they can look that up online or?
Yeah. Institute of Functional Medicine.
Okay.
They can just look that up online.
Thank you. That was Amy Leeser. And she, you know, talking about the true cost of food, folks, and we've talked about this before, but excess weight and obesity costs about $2 trillion globally in healthcare costs. Subsidies and insurance to farmers in the United States cost the taxpayers $20 billion per year. Antibiotic resistance costs $55 billion a year right here in the United States. And, of course, that's because they have to pump their animals up with antibiotics to keep them from getting sick. And then, you know, then when we eat the food, we get that antibiotic, and then if we need the antibiotic, it doesn't do much good for us as well. The endocrine-disrupting chemicals found in pesticides, as, you know, Alexander, you were talking about, and how you're pesticide-free, so they're, you know, lower health care costs, and that's huge, I believe. Don't you agree?
Yeah, as I think that's one of the biggest issues that we face is pesticides and the runoff, the biodiversity loss that's created, and you know, a big part of that unaccounted for cost is what happens, you know, after the pesticide is sprayed on. Like the yeah. crop might be free, but the damage to the surrounding area is not, it's not really accounted for.
Well, that's exactly
obviously
right.
We completely cut that out with what we do.
Yeah. And then of course, low wages, mm-hmm. you know, paid by, say like McDonald's costs the taxpayers $153 billion a year in government assistance programs. And, you know, I'm looking at this going, gosh, if we could save a good part of this by eating sustainably grown food, such as Babylon Microfarms, and then, you know, the healthcare cost goes down. Well, you could take that money, if you save that money, and actually pay for healthcare for all.
It's, yeah, well, as in we can hope. We certainly have to aspire to something like that. You know, as right. I was saying earlier, like we're really part of a bigger solution. And but the thing is, I think we're seeing this, and you, all of this talk about urban agriculture, is organic biodiversity, all of these things are part of a big picture shift that is really more than a shift. It is going to become a way of life because it is a necessary step. And I think that the evidence is now getting to the point where it is kind of so indisputable that the change needs to happen. It's just really a matter of how quickly that change is going to happen. And I think what we're seeing in this space and the energy and the investment that's going into it, even in just the last 18 months, I think that transition is, we're really at a kind of inflection point. And the tipping, there will be a sort of seismic shift where these kind of old practices are faded out over the next decade or so.
Well, let's hope so, because right now the industry is slanted in favor of the factory farms and unsustainable food, which makes us sick. That just makes no sense.
As in, I think corporate lobbying has a lot to do with that.
I absolutely agree. And I've said, and the only politics I'll talk about on this show is how that, as you say, the corporate, you know, folks, if you think about it, if you are in charge of the people that regulate you, the regulations are going to be in your favor. And, you know, if somebody is polluting a waterway or the soil or the air, and that needs to put a regulation on that to stop you from doing it, but you own those people because, you know, your big corporation pays all their campaign and this and that and everything else, they're not going to vote in favor of that regulation that is needed. And so it's really the fox watching the hen house.
Exactly.
And so, you know, you get private money out of elections. And I think there's a whole grassroots movement right now, even in Congress, to do exactly that. And that way you have no corporate influence. And that would be a dream come true, wouldn't it?
We'll see how.
Yeah,
how
I know.
Go.
Is that going to happen? You know, like you get your Pollyanna on here.
The problem, like, there is nothing wrong with corporate influence. It's just the corporate abuse of power, I think.
Well, it is an abuse, and I agree. And yeah. I think there's a place for corporations in the country. Absolutely, 100%. Not in my food system, you know, stay out of my food system. And that's why you try to eat sustainably. And that's where you come in. That's where a lot of our farmers in the area are actually doing that as well, without the pesticides and herbicides. And, you know, we are very fortunate, I believe, in this area, don't you?
Yeah. I think Charlottesville is obviously a great place for this. And I think Virginia and the works of Polyface Farms and other places, you know, I think it's really leading the charge for this kind of sustainable and biodiverse food
well,
system.
And the people are demanding it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that's huge. And that, of course, is where it starts. That's why City Soulyard Gardens and Babylon Microfarms, you know, you're showing people, you know, how to eat sustainably right here, you know, in the local area.
I think that's kind of where, like, so ag tech is the kind of buzzword for agricultural technology, which is a very emerging space because it's a whole segment that lags decades behind the rest of the world in terms of technology. And what all we're doing is really just harnessing some of the technology that we've developed as a society and using those to give new tools to farmers for, you know, sustainable practices. Mm-hmm, and so, and I think we're seeing a lot of that is, you know, beyond what we're doing, where actually, yeah, there are so many opportunities for people to use these technologies to have to grow food sustainably and kind of embrace that, the productivity and the benefits of it.
I'll tell you what. Now, you mentioned earlier you're going to be doing a TED Talk.
Yeah, so February 16th, TEDx is coming to
February 16th, okay.
To the University of Virginia, mm-hmm. And I will be there. So if anyone, I think it is open to the public, so if anyone wants to come down, please do.
Where is that going to be held?
It's in the Rotunda.
In the Rotunda, good place.
Yeah.
And that's February 16th?
Yes, the Saturday the 16th.
Saturday the 16th, right. And that's great. Actually, Saturday the 16th, we have Jamie from Bel Air Farm will be on. Our show that day, so check that out, folks. Next week we have Heidi Reed on from One Forest, and that is a wonderful program that takes young children, and I believe their parents are involved in this as well, but teaches them how to go into the forest and find things that are actually good for you and medicinal plants and all that. It's just a really wonderful education that they're doing out there in Nelson County. So she'll be here next week, and then Jamie from Bel Air will be with us the following week. And February 16th, TED Talk at the Rotunda. And what time does that start?
Good question. I think.
Okay, got to look it up. Check the calendar.
But I think it's
well, just like check it out.
11 till 2.
Yeah,
but you can. It's online too.
Oh, that's great. Oh, okay. So they can actually stream it.
I don't know that either.
Actually. Oh,
but okay. They have a website with all the details,
all the information, and all that sort of thing. Oh, that's excellent. That is cool. Well, that just about does it for us here at To Your Health, and I've really enjoyed talking to you, Alexander.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. And that's BabylonMicroFarms.com for more information and check it out. It's amazing what you guys are doing.
Well, thank you so much. And yeah, plenty more to come this year.
All right. Excellent.
You've been listening to Your Health with your host, MC Blair. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating over 20 years of sustainable fine dining on Downtown Mall, and by Rebecca's Natural Foods in Barracks Road Shopping Center. Be listening again next Saturday morning at 11 for To Your Health.